Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Our panel today, Mick Clifford is special correspondent with the Irish Examiner. Kate English is the chief economist at Deloitte Ireland. John O'Brien is professor of European politics in Maynooth University. And Shana Cohn is executive director of the independent think tank TASC. Good morning, everyone.
Morning, Brendan. Morning.
John O'Brien, this is your area of expertise. This drone incursion, I think, kind of played down. Well, the government weren't telling us anything initially. The visit went perfectly. It's as each day that goes by, we seem to realise that this is actually more serious than we thought, and more revelations on it today. Is it possible or probable that the Russians were trying to kill Vladimir Zelensky in Irish airspace?
In a word, yes.
Really?
The Russians have tried to assassinate Zelensky a number of times over recent years, including in the initial push, remember, where they tried to take Kyiv. The plan was to assassinate him and to replace him with a puppet president who would do Russia's bidding. Now, for us, this wasn't unprecedented because we've seen different kinds of Russian maneuvers in our territorial waters and in the skies in recent years. But think about what might have happened. If that plane had come down, and I think we got very lucky because Zelensky's people came in significantly early.
But would they not have been able to track that plane the way, like, I know kids on iPhones can track planes now, or would that plane maybe not be as trackable?
Sure, but I think it's very possible that the Russians would have had counter technology that might have allowed them to do this. Now, remember that this week Putin said almost directly...
Did we just get lucky here, like... Do you think there's a possibility we just got lucky?
I think
Zelensky could have, having survived everything the last 3 years, could have been killed in Ireland.
Yeah, the Russians have been upping the ante with a whole range of different kinds of attacks, including on airports and repeated incursions into the airspace of European countries, sometimes with aircraft, sometimes with drones. These were five military-style zones, each of them the size of a wood pallet. And I think that if that plane had come down, it would have been a reputational catastrophe for Ireland, because it would have revealed to the world that we have virtually no systems of security and defence, and that no European leaders coming to Ireland would be safe. Now, think about the context. This was being built.
Did our security work in this situation?
Well, John Mooney's report is extraordinary, Brendan. He says that, amongst other things, no effort was made to precisely locate the drones, despite the no-fly zone or exclusion zone that had been put in place. And due to, quote, the confusion about what state agency was responsible. So the Gardaí now seem to be blaming the naval service. The naval service is saying that their rules of engagement prevented them actually attacking these drones. And as you say, the government imposed a kind of omerta for a number of days. So I think there's a lot of investigation to be done. The Gardaí only started their inquiry on Friday. Much more may come out of that. But I think the other significant thing in the Sunday Times
Can I ask you one other question? You mentioned rules of engagement there. Do you think we have a system of rules of engagement now and decision making going right up to the Taoiseach about actions like this that are suitable for the world we're living in?
I think we're way behind, but we are in transition. And John Mooney does an interview with the new Chief of Staff of the Defence Forces, Lieutenant General Rossin Mulcahy. And that's very interesting because what he is pointing to is a completely different approach, which means a whole of government approach to defence and almost a redefinition of defence. In a way, we have been living in a 20th century world. And we haven't caught up or even attempted to catch up to the new security landscape that has evolved over the last 20 years or so. We have real responsibilities here. Next year, we host the presidency of the European Union Council. There'll be all kinds of meetings in Dublin. General Mulcahy mentions the preparations that have gone on for this. But in the run-up to the visit of Zelensky, this was being portrayed as a trial run for next year. Well, God help us if we see any repeat of what happened this week, because we're going to have prime ministers and presidents from every European Union member state, along with ministers coming here regularly. And we have to change, I think, almost everything about the way we approach security and defence. We simply haven't been taking it seriously. The Russians know that. They see us as the weak underbelly of European security. They were trying to demonstrate, I think, at the very least, that they had the capacity to do this and that they could take aim at countries like Ireland, where they know that we don't have a sufficiently robust
security. So it could have been another one of their probing exercises.
Probative, you're right. But I think it was equally focused on exposing the lack of a serious defence capacity here. And it could well have been a serious effort to assassinate Zelensky. And I'm inclined to believe that is the case. Because
we don't want to fearmonger too much either, but you're a credible voice in this. One more question, I'll bring in the rest of the panel then. So I'm thinking of Pete Hegseth, and I'm probably thinking of movies now, and people are in a situation room and they're being asked, do we strike or not? Do we have the... Are we going to have a system in Ireland, or do we have a system whereby in a situation like that with drones, that goes right up the line to the Minister for Defence, possibly the Taoiseach, to say, are we shooting these down or not? And there's a protocol there.
Yes, that's what we're looking at. And one of the points I think made by General Mulcahy is that we've never been in this situation before in Ireland. Other European countries have been because of their proximity to Russia, but the world has changed. Geography has collapsed. It means nothing anymore. So geographic position is completely irrelevant. I can assure you, viewed from Moscow, we are not viewed as a militarily neutral state. We are a core part of the West.
Okay. And just look, there's a text there. There's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that Russia was involved in these drones. This is fear-mongering to further the agenda of spending more on military. And look, we don't know. We do not know yet. We'll agree with that. Mick, you were looking at that piece as well, the John Mooney piece.
Yeah, it's very interesting, as John said. Just a couple of things about it. First of all, you mentioned about rules of engagement, and to be fair, I mean, as I understand it, the decision not to engage with those drones was on the basis that it didn't pose the immediate threat at that time because Zelensky had come in here earlier.
Okay.
So I think there was that there. The other thing is how slow this is taking. You're back to an old problem. You're talking about 20th century infrastructure, whatever. The security of the state is in the brief of the Gardaí, and traditionally that was the way because the threat was from within the island rather than externally. Okay. And that seems to be one thing we need to catch up with. Just apart from that, this is a scenario whereby the world outside Ireland is meeting the world inside Ireland. This is what's going on. Russia is a belligerent. It is threatening Europe. It has invaded Ukraine. It is a threat to Western values, certainly in Europe, whatever about America. Internally in this country, we're about to launch into a big debate over a triple lock and whether or not we need to maintain this, allegedly, to maintain our neutrality. The rest of the world must be looking at this thinking, think it's for the birds.
Okay, the triple lock and neutrality are two separate issues.
They absolutely are, but they're being purposely conflated, is the point I'm making. And the fact that basically it's way behind the times any discussion on that. The idea that we're having a big argument over whether or not on the UN Security Council, the US, of which there's questions over, China, Russia, in the current environment, have a say over whether or not we deploy more than 12 troops abroad. It makes absolutely no sense, yet that's internally in this country the thrust of public debate
wrestling, what's going wrestling on in the with our world. Conscience, pirouetting on the plinth, as the man used to say. Shane O'Cohen, people are going to say now we've a bunch of warmongers on the panel and the military industrial complex is being talked up. You looked at that interview with Rossa Mulcahy, Chief of Staff of the Defence Forces. What did you take from it?
I think that it's a complicated issue, but the reality is that you have Russian subs like hovering over the undersea cable network. And for me, I think that there's an issue with what just happened with Zelensky and preparations that are necessary for the presidency next year. But there's an immediate issue with the fact that Ireland has these undersea cables that are fundamental to business investment in Ireland from American companies and to our relationships with other European countries. So there's no, I don't think there's any question we're going to have to do something. It may not be calling up a draft or building a defense, but there have to be security measures taken to protect the infrastructure that's around Ireland. And the reality,
he mentioned in that piece about having a reserve, more of a reserve force, doesn't he?
He talks about the Finnish model, which is they've, you know, they've joined NATO and they've adopted this strategy of building up reserves. So 1 million people could be called up in case of war with Russia. Now, they're on the border, and they've been at war with Russia before. Yeah. Yeah. So they're going to be more aware of it than we are. But yeah, that's a question. I don't see the possibility of that happening here.
Okay. But you would be a person of the left?
Yeah, I guess
so. Are even the left now agreeing that maybe we need to get on board slightly with the military-industrial complex and start taking these matters more seriously?
That term is a 20th century term for me,
to
be really frank. I think that our economy is dependent upon American investment, like it or not. So if you want to protect that investment or even the high-tech industry in general, you have to recognize that our infrastructure is not protected adequately. And Russian submarines hovering around in our waters. And the other side, if there's been a lot of talk about decolonization, the reality is that Ireland is very dependent on the British military. And that's a question that needs to be considered. The RAF will help us. The British Navy will help us. But is that the relationship we can continue to rely on? And is that the best way forward?
Okay. Kate, you also looked at, actually, let's move it on a bit. You looked at Éilidh O'Hanlon in the Sunday Independent. You picked singing Give Peace a Chance is not a credible foreign policy for Ireland.
Yeah, there was one particular line actually in this piece by Éilidh O'Hanlon that struck out to me, and it was, Ireland is not at war, but we are in Europe and Europe is not at peace. And I think it's back to, I'm no expert in this area, and I think a lot has already been covered on it. But, you know, we're going to see this topic and this debate in Ireland come to the fore a lot more as we move into 2026. We know the presidential election is coming here next year, and we've spoken already about
President of Europe.
We know you spoke already about those geographical boundaries maybe no longer being there. But I think what is clear is that Ireland sits at the edge of Europe, but at the moment we are at the epicentre of the risk map. It's back to the underwater sea cables you spoke about, Shanna.
Okay, we are a hub essentially there. Yeah.
Yes, and that we're all feeling that that exposure that's, I think, coming to the fore that we've had from a long time of underinvestment within our defence forces and our security here within Ireland. And I certainly, as someone who is not an expert in this area, am feeling that exposure more and more. And this week, the coverage of it across articles this weekend just reinforces that more. You know, and we had a piece in the Sunday Times as well with, again, another good line in it saying that strengthening our defence forces and security apparatus is not a threat to our neutrality. It is a threat to our national security to do nothing. And again, that struck with me and relates back to that piece by Eilish as well of, we're not at war, but Europe is not at peace and we are part of Europe.
Yeah, John, you wanted to come in there.
Yeah, to take up the point that Éilidh O'Hanlon makes, I think she's got it slightly wrong. Russia has been at war with Europe since 2014. This is the reality that we're only beginning to confront now. Remember, at that time, they sent troops into Crimea, but they also did other things. For example, they brought down a Malaysian Airlines plane that had 300 civilians in it, most of them European Union citizens. And since then, it's been a relentless mixture of the hybrid attacks that you described, Brendan, at the head of the show, of things like attacking arms dumps in Bulgaria and the Czech Republic, of planes and drones. The Europeans have done nothing in response except put in place this very patchy sanctions regime, which the Russians actually have been able to more than avoid with the help of India and China.
Okay.
So we just have to get serious. And at some
point,
they're going to have to take down these drones or planes.
Okay, so the drones is one thing. They're clearly capable of doing that while pursuing a special military operation, a full-scale war in Ukraine, into which they are throwing, their whole economy is geared towards it. They are throwing like hundreds of thousands of lives and casualties at it. Are they really going to have the kind of energy to start invading more places, given the pace they're at, moving at in Ukraine? Like, are they really a credible threat to go any further?
Well, firstly, we need to read Putin and to listen to him and understand him. Most people don't. We get sort of fragments that people pick up from things they see on television. He is deadly serious when he describes Europe as the enemy. The really big change, however, for us this year is the position of the United States, which used to be the prime guarantor of European security. Trump has pivoted to Putin because he really admires him as an authoritarian. Trump, if you read the national security statement,
this
which
is
came
the document
out
on Friday,
end of the week, it was completely alarming from a European point of view because they basically say Europe is our adversary. Now, I thought early in the year NATO was over; it was finished. And again, Hegseth and Trump have said they would not come to the rescue of Europeans if Estonia, for example, was to be attacked. We have to take that seriously. It means an independent European security capacity because NATO just does not exist any longer. And for us, the decision is, what kind of role do we possibly play in this new security environment? We have to take that question seriously.
Okay, and we are upping our defence spending and we have applied to be part of the European funding for defence and everything. Just on a kind of a side note of all this, Shana, you picked a piece in the Mail on Sunday. Pathetic doublespeak from PBP makes a clear case for our defence.
Yeah, I think that going back to the 20th century rhetoric, I don't think it's possible to continue to think, well, we're going to be neutral means we're not going to get into these conflicts. But also, People Before Profit, when Zelensky came in, they weren't there to congratulate him. Or the rhetoric that
they didn't clap. They did say that they, you know, the Russian invasion is wrong and all that kind of thing.
They have, yes. Yeah. I think there's a wider picture that we're missing in kind of the discussions that, to go back to the Trump, I mean, I'm obviously American, right? I have Irish citizenship, but I'm American. I'm from Texas. So Trump is partly, if you listen to the analysis of that strategy, that some of it is complete. It's Trump's rhetoric. It's Trump and his group, like Heritage Foundation, sitting around coming up with a Monroe Doctrine.
Like, I've seen it being dismissed by fairly credible people as that's just another.
Yeah, I don't think it could be completely dismissed because he's increasingly unpopular within the U.S. His ratings are terrible, right? He's unsuccessful with quite a lot of things, just like Putin. Or you want to go into Israel, Netanyahu is unpopular. He's an unpopular prime minister. It's the fact what they will do to keep their power in order to retain the power, the measures they'll take. I don't think Trump has the internal domestic standing to enforce this. It doesn't make sense for the American economy, which is shrinking because of his policies. And he doesn't have, I'm assuming, the backing of defense. I would imagine Hegseth is ridiculed every time he walks out of the room. He's, and I don't know how long he's going to stay because he might be convicted.
Is Trump becoming a lame duck?
He is a lame duck.
Yeah.
He can't run again. He's a lame duck. And his vice president is not particularly popular. Vance's ideology was all over that strategy because Vance was lecturing, you know, about the AFD needs to be respected, extreme, you know, the far right movements. It's this brand of Republican ideology called conservative nationalism that's taken a hold of the party. But on the other hand, I don't think it can be dismissed just like I don't think the infrastructure.
Okay, we might come back to Trump and America anyway. Mick, you picked a piece in the Sunday Times, Herzog Park Row is Struggle for Ireland's Soul by Jason Johnson.
Yeah, this is an interview with granddaughter of Chaim Herzog, Alexandra Herzog, and she is saying that her grandfather would be dismayed at this. The family are discussing what we're talking about is the attempt to dename Herzog Park in Rathgar in Dublin. He would probably see this as a struggle over the soul of Ireland, she said, adding that the furore had shaken her family. She said, people have every right to protest peacefully, to criticise Israeli policy or military action and to express solidarity with Palestinians. You can support Israel's right to exist while also caring deeply about Palestinian suffering. This is not and should not be treated as an either-or situation. And it's a very good interview, and I mean, it fairly brings it home. I mean, this I think a lot of people would have perceived it as going beyond what you might call gestures that we have made. And I don't mean gestures in a pejorative way, in support of Palestinians and what they're going through now. This definitely seemed to have strayed into the area of attacking the legacy of this man on the basis of a rewriting of history in terms of his role in this country and in terms of whether or not he should have been honoured, notwithstanding his involvement in the formation of Israel back in 1948. And I think it's ripe for being portrayed as being anti-Semitic. Yeah. Whether or not it is, yeah, we put up there. But in terms,
but even in a country that is overwhelmingly supportive of Palestine, most people seem to agree that this was...
It was a step too far.
Shana, did you view it as anti-Semitic, given that you're the one person here who could possibly legitimately feel that or not?
I think it reflects very sloppy thinking. I know Pranchi Starasa because he founded Task, and I saw his letter to the Irish Times about a few days ago really resonated, because it's just sloppy thinking. Yeah, and my kids went to the school next to the park, and which is a Jewish school. And
this is Stratford College.
College, yeah. I just think it's really the wrong, it's wrongheaded on a lot of levels. It's sloppy intellectually. It doesn't recognize the influence of Irish nationalism on both sides of the conflict in the Middle East. And that's historical, that's a fact. You can read it in the interview with Herzog's granddaughter. But more importantly, I think if you're going to talk about decency, which is some of the language that's been used, You know, the protests are right next to a school which has a Jewish ethos.
You don't have to say if you don't want to. Has this impacted on your kids? Is it in their heads and in their lives?
Sure, absolutely. Past couple years have not been very easy, but I don't think it's just like characteristic of Ireland. I think it's across the world. It's unfortunately because you have a really noxious, terrible government in Ireland, but it's indicative of some of the governments we have around the world. I mean, I don't like the government in the U.S. either, but they're all in this far right, very nationalistic vein, with pervasive corruption, et cetera. So, yeah, I don't think it's not been easy, because we've all been drawn into the conflict. But I think having a protest next to a school personally, I think it's offensive. I think you shouldn't do it.
Is it hard for your kids being Jewish in Ireland right now? Do you mind me asking?
I don't think it would be any different anywhere else, but I think you wouldn't necessarily, for safety purposes, or just not safety.
Do you think it's hard to be Jewish anywhere in the world right now?
I think it is hard to be Jewish anywhere in the world, because you're drawn into the conflict, and it's...
What's your relationship or your feelings about the state of Israel, the government, etc.?
I don't like the government. I've never had much sympathy for Netanyahu.
And do you feel a heart and soul connection with the state of Israel?
I'd say I don't have any family there. I'm Jewish, and it's a Jewish state, so there is a connection, just because if I identify as Jewish, then there's the Jewish state. So, but the security, it's been clear, I think, over the past couple of years for everybody that the peace in the region is fundamental to our own security, being Jewish outside of Israel. So there is more of investment being in the diaspora.
Yeah.
In some sort of resolution for the conflict, for our own sake, not just for the sake of Israelis and Palestinians.
Yeah. John?
Well, I thought it was an obnoxious thing to attempt to change the name of the park, and I'm very glad that it's been rethought and rescinded. But what it did was really present a gift to the IDF and Israeli propagandists. And it was very interesting to see how they sought to use it, because there's been this relentless campaign over the last number of years to try and depict Ireland as institutionally and structurally anti-Semitic. And that simply is not true. There is anti-Semitism here, for sure. And I know that Jewish people have experienced it, and it's terrible when they do. But to suggest that the state itself is somehow structurally anti-Semitic, I think, is wholly wrong. I often get accused, by the way.
You're really into the Eurovision, right?
Yes.
You're a big fan. So the Eurovision decision then seems to have landed very differently with
yes.
people.
It smacks of incredible hypocrisy. How can you throw out the Russians on the basis of the crimes of humanity, against humanity they committed in Ukraine? Israel has killed almost exactly the same number of civilians in Gaza as Russia has in Ukraine. So on the grounds of the double standard alone, you could not possibly justify the decision to let Israel continue in the
and
competition.
And you think we were right?
We were right to do it. But yeah. Every time something like this happens, you get this chorus appearing saying that Ireland is anti-Semitic. I get accused of it all the time because I'm pro-Palestinian. And I try to say to people, you know what? The only reason I'm an academic is the Holocaust. Because it had such a searing impact on me to learn what individuals were capable of in that period in which it happened. And of course, there'd been many, many other episodes, pogroms against Jewish people in Europe. It was appalling. I've been to many of the concentration camps where the worst things in Europe happened. But this conflation of support for Palestine with being an anti-Semite, it's horrendous, okay. And it has to stop.
Shana,
every political leader
as
in
a
Ireland
Jewish
opposed
person,
that
what do you
decision
think about
week.
The Eurovision decision?
I think it was pretty predictable that Ireland and the countries they'd already stated they were going to withdraw. And there is an argument to say that if you're going to throw out Russia and you know Israel's being accused of genocide in Gaza, that there is an argument. But the only hesitation I've had about that is that the public brought, like, being a good far-right government, the Netanyahu government has relentlessly attacked the public broadcaster, and they're trying to privatize it. It's the same methods you'd see in the U.S. of trying to consolidate media control, and so to have one far-right messaging message.
They would view Cannes, the broadcaster, as a hotbed of kind of left-wing radicals, kind of in the grand tradition.
Shouldn't have an independent broadcaster. The broadcaster should reflect the views of the government. That's what the Netanyahu government wants.
So is there a danger? Are you saying you think there's a danger that we're penalizing a broadcaster here that is actually, like, kind of on the opposite side to the government that we're trying to censure?
I don't know if they're on the opposite side. They're independent and they're trying to retain their independence. You can see there's a movie called The Sea, which is about a Palestinian family that won a prize in Israel or something. And the Netanyahu government got really upset because it was about Palestinians, but they defended I think it was Khan. They defended their choice. Okay. So I just think if you're going to, again, going back to a resolution, you have to protect what's remaining of democracy within Israel, or you'll never get to equal rights between Palestinians and Jews. It'll just always be this kind of second-class citizenship.
Okay, and you're saying that Khan is one of those things worth protecting?
Even if RTE, continues with its decision, and that's up to RTE and the other broadcasters, there has to be a recognition that you want to support whoever wants, like, a path out of this toward equal rights.
Okay. Mick, just briefly, Brenda Power, those who slate Israel should at least own up to it in the Sunday Times.
Yeah, she's making the point about, all the various actions we've taken, and we insist we're not anti-Semitic, and you'd have to wonder collectively, kind of, does it add up to it? I mean, a bit similar to the other topic, Brendan. Again, there seems to be a very different perception outside of Ireland than within Ireland. I mean, outside of Ireland, we're regarded as being extremely pro-Palestinian. For instance, the withdrawal of the Israeli ambassador, all of that within Europe, we're regarded in those terms. Within Ireland, you have those who describe themselves as being on the left using this term complicit in genocide in relation to everything. You have, for instance, in Dublin City Council last week in a debate on this issue, you had people suggesting that Ireland, the Irish government, were taking their lead from Israel. So you have this setup within the country that's completely at odds with the perception outside of it, and I'd suggest very much at odds with what the majority of the public feel, but because you have loud voices in that sector, they keep claiming we must go further. And when you go too far, as you did here, you stray into that area of possibly being anti-Semitic.
Would you agree, Shana? Has the left lost its moral compass somewhere here on this?
I think they're good intentions. You want to see an end to the mass killing and the destruction and, what's going
on
in the West Bank.
Which everyone does.
Yeah. So I just think it's the strategy is misplaced. And and it can end up being, I think some of the comments I've heard have been pretty offensive. But it's not just they're ignorant. And that's what I get frustrated because actually my academic career is in North Africa. And so you have to look at the conflict in the context of the region. It's just some of it is, there's a lot of ignorance about it because it isn't sort of a classic colonial exercise going back to the Holocaust. You had an enormous refugee population in Europe after World War II, and that's where the refugees went. So it's as Palestinian rhetoric has said, the narrative is, the refugees have made refugees. And that's the basis for trying to address the conflict is you have two very insecure peoples in terms of statehood and their existential survival.
Okay, we'll leave that there and we'll take a break. Mick Clifford, Kate English, John O'Brien and Shane O'Connor staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get professional advice on blood pressure and glucose checks at Allcare Pharmacy.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Mick Clifford, Kate English, John O'Brien and Shane O'Connor still with us. Kate English, with your Deloitte hat on now, there's a lot about, my feeling today reading the infrastructure stuff was, I thought, it's all going to be grand, it's sorted. We've two guys in the business post who say, we'll build a metro, no problem. We built a huge one in Australia. One of them's even Irish and they're like, we've been dying to come home and get a project. Then we have, and you pick this, so Sean O'Driscoll, who is a member of the Accelerating Infrastructure Task Force, he's formerly Glen Dimplex, one of the few actual Irish companies that grew to a huge size. He is talking to Daniel McConnell and he's saying we're losing billions, but he's talking tough, isn't he?
He's talking tough. And, this to me, actually, his line near the start of the article says a lot about the report this week. Remember, the task force report this week, it addressed those 12 barriers to infrastructure that were outlined earlier in the summer. And it put forward 30 actions to solve those barriers and get infrastructure
so
delivered.
So not intentions, not we will focus on actions.
Actions.
And so you like
those
that, yeah?
Actions, why I like those is that those actions were time bound. We got almost a roadmap of when each of those actions were to be complete. And as Sean O'Driscoll says, he says there are very, very clear lines of accountability and the task force will not be afraid to call it out. So the task force have been established. They have helped in this drafting of the report. But importantly, they remain in place now and will be that body to call the government to account on where do you sit with action 3 that you said would be completed in the first quarter of 2026. So there puts pressure on this to not only be a report that gets dusty sitting on a shelf, but for there to be real change come out of it. Similarly, we see with those 30 actions, the majority of them actually are placed towards, or certainly a sizable amount of them, to take place in the first half of next year. And to us as listeners, people who live in the island of Ireland, that means we should be able to see quite early into 2026 if what was laid out in this report is actually going to make any difference.
So if Deloitte themselves had come in and done a report, which you're very good at, you would say this is a model of a good action plan and strategy, would you?
Maybe a stretch far to say a model on it.
All right, I pushed it slightly too far.
But certainly...
better than most.
Yeah, and is a good report. And it comes back to, it was widely covered on the papers today. We also saw by Killian Woods, page 13 of the Business Post, he said the industry wants action, not words, on sorting out our infrastructure mess.
Okay, so you know the old thing, culture eats strategy for breakfast. And this is a thing that you see in your job in Deloitte and as a consultant and all that kind of thing. All the actions in the world, it's very hard to turn around the way we do things around here, as culture is called, isn't it? And like the way we do things around here is so ingrained in people's attitudes, in the legal system, everything. It's like turning around an ocean liner here, is it?
Yeah, this is a big ship to try and turn around. And that is, though, again, I think it's healthy that that is recognised in those 12 barriers that I spoke about earlier. There's a recognition of a risk aversion, not only in at a government level, but also at a societal level as well, of wanting to take risk when it comes to delivering large infrastructure. And we know why. We have been burnt by it in the past. We don't need to list off some of the failures that were there or overrunning of budgets. But we need to move past that kind of inertia that we have
We need to be willing for things to fail as well, correct? Yeah, and not like get tied up in 10 years and figuring out why they failed.
Yeah, and
move on
and do something that we haven't done before.
Mick, the one thing you'd say is this isn't this all these great plans and actions have yet to hit the infamous Irish legal system.
Yeah. Legal system is one element to it, and there will be challenges, particularly in relation to judicial reviews. But
so there's going to be challenges to the plans to the plans that are meant to minimise the challenges.
I'd be surprised if there wasn't, to be honest with you, on the basis of what people feel is what would be suggested is an infringement on people's rights to observe or to protest against developments or whatever. Do I think it is?
Yeah.
No, I think, first of all, I think there's too much emphasis put on the judicial review thing. I think absolutely. I mean, this judicial review business only started really exploding when they brought in strategic housing developments, which was a skip in the planning process from local authorities going straight to Bord Pleanála. And, you know, there are arguments for and against. There's definitely an argument in terms of the system whereby if a fault is spotted, that things can't begin again from there. You have to go back to the start and all that. But overall, I think really what you're talking about here, and it feeds in with kids, you're talking about, more than anything, you're talking about political will. And that has not been there because it will upset some elements. One example that I'm surprised hasn't been touched on much this week, but really sums it up, infrastructure or energy infrastructure. Wind energy is key to that. There have been flashpoints all over the country about objections to wind energy and all that. We have not had a change in the statutory guidelines for wind energy. That means how far turbines are from homes and all that sort of thing. Since 2006. Now, the development in the industry since then has been exponential. And the reason we have not upgraded, and I followed this, they've come a bit of the way and more of the way, come repeatedly. The reason it has not been upgraded is because politically they can't balance what the developers for wind energy wants against the likely backlash against residents, and that opposition politicians will jump on that, they'll lose seats. Politically, that has been the issue. Now, if we can't...
So the new culture in Ireland is going to be, we're told, that the common good will trump all.
Exactly, yeah. So we're told. What is the common good? Is the common good, for instance, the common good of homeowners or those who are at the heart of the electorate, older people? Or is the common good for everybody, including people who are trying to get homes?
Okay, Shaina, just before we leave this, you looked at a piece in the Business Post, 5 Ways Ireland Can Learn from How Other Countries Have Got Things Done.
Yeah, that was the same kind of issue, like how will you consult with communities? And it's breaking down the silos within government, talking about culture, that you can't separate out housing from infrastructure because you don't want to build a lot of housing, but there's not enough electricity to support the number of households. So she was very good at just summing up how other countries...
This is Maeve Jennings.
She was very good at saying... But I think the one thing that stuck with me was there needs to be some sort of strategy to consult with communities that's effective and efficient. Unless, you don't do that, then you are going to have the legal...
Another point that's been made is that you just pay people off as well. This is a legitimate thing that happens in all law cases. You just pay people off and move on.
Yeah, but like the other thing there is that you're back to mentality. The vast majority of objections, I would suggest, have nothing to do with planning. They have simply to do with, this might impinge on my lifestyle. 1%, 2%, 5%, therefore I don't want it, and good luck with your common good. And Killian Woods, it's an excellent piece in the Business Post.
So you compensate people. Does that not make sense? Is that not much faster way of doing it?
So therefore, Brendan, everywhere you have a new development, automatically what you're saying there is that everybody in the area needs to be, as you're describing it, paid off.
Yeah, but Mick, what you're not seeing is that I would suggest we set up a body to do this. Anyway, let's move on to there's a poll in the Sunday Independent. Just before we get into it, I'll just give us the state of the parties, right? If there was another general election held immediately, who would get your number one preference? And this poll was conducted Thursday, Friday, of this week. It was text-based. Changes indicated are since the last poll. Last month, sample size 1,069, margin of error plus or minus 3%. So Sinn Féin are at 24% up 1 in this. Fianna Fáil is at 20% up 2 in this. Fine Gael is at 17% down 2 in this poll. Independents and others are up 1 at 11%. Social Democrats down 1 but still at 8%. Aintu down 1 at 5%. Independent Ireland 5%, no change. Labour Party 5%, no change. People Before Profit Solidarity 3%, no change. And Green Party 2%, no change. John, you picked Fionn Sheehan as a piece with that. The Gough isn't working. We're fed up with Fine Gael. But I think just on the poll in general, your observations.
Well, the headline is about Fine Gael, I think, because it is the lowest score that they've had in an opinion poll in 10 years. And I think that's what the writing this morning is zoning in on. There's also the question of Simon Harris's leadership, I think. The decision to move to finance wasn't universally popular within Fine Gael.
This poll suggests it's unpopular with the public as well.
Yeah, but I'm not sure there's anything that surprising here, given the fact that Fine Gael have been in office now since 2011. Simple truth is, even if people are doing very well in power, we kind of get tired of the old faces. Now, of course, we've seen a departure of quite a few of those faces within Fine Gael. We forget how young many of those people were when they actually came to office. And politics does wear you down. It's a 24-hour job virtually. But I think that's really bad news for Fine Gael, and they'd want to really pay heed to this. One of the other columns there is by the political scientist Kevin Cunningham, and he's talking about potential rivals to Simon Harris in Fine Gael. And his argument is that he's kind of okay because we don't see the emergence of any specific rival in the way, for example, that Jim O'Callaghan has emerged potentially as a successor to Micheál Martin. Now, I'm not sure that's true. I think the next Fine Gael leadership may well be between Jennifer Carl McNeill and Helen McEntee. How far that off is quite a question. But for both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, coming up to the next general election, the big question is, do they go into the election with fresh faces and fresh blood in leadership terms, or do they persevere with Harris and Martin?
Okay, Mick, what did you make of it all?
There's not much change. Like, I mean, you know, a lot of us, we expect 70% of people disagree with Simon Harris going to finance, 68% blame Micheál Martin for the presidential debacle. Well, does that matter? I mean, in terms of fresh faces, as John is suggesting, I think there's no way Micheál Martin will be leading Fianna Fáil into the next election. It's just a question of when he decides, or others decide, when he is to leave. But I mean, he'll be 69 then. He's already, I think it's 15 years this year, he will be leader of Fianna Fáil. That's the second highest after De Valera. And irrespective of the outcome of this inquiry into the presidential thing or any of that, I don't see that happening.
They probably leave him in place for the potential security nightmare that is
the
presidency of Europe.
Blame for that.
Yeah. Kate, just on that, the Business Post, Daniel Murray has a piece, State to Tread Carefully as the Good Tax Times Roll. And that, of course, will be central to the popularity of everyone. Now, am I right in thinking we're not thinking that corporation tax is falling off a cliff anytime soon?
No, it's not falling off a cliff. And as we saw on that piece by Daniel Murray, he pulls out we had November Exchequer results released on Wednesday or Thursday of this week. And we see from that corporation tax receipts in just November alone this year were more than 2014 as a whole. We have seen exceptional levels of growth in our corporation tax receipts over the past decade and overall in our collective tax receipts. And we oftentimes put a lot of focus on corporation tax receipts, but we also equally have very strong tax increases in receipts as well, and income tax and VAT at the minute. And why do I pull those out? Well, as an economist, they give me a good read as to, well, how is our consumer behaving and how is our labour market performing? When we see an increase of just under 5% in income tax receipts this year, it shows you that we still have a resilient or holding labour market despite a very volatile external environment, which you could have placed a question mark over at the start of this year. Similarly, the same with that rise in VAT receipts. It's a signal of consumer spending continuing to take place.
Okay, so for certainly probably three quarters of the country, if you look at most polls, right, three quarters of the country probably keeping their head above water are thriving. So that other quarter who are you know, choosing between heating and eating and all that kind of thing, should they have been given something so in the budget? Should they have been given energy? Like, they hear then, we took in 10 billion in November, more than ever. Taxes are booming. And we know we're saving some, and we know we're spending it on infrastructure. But if people feel poor in a country that's rich, is that not cognitive dissonance there?
Yeah, I think latest surveys have shown it's just under about 50% of households are kind of struggling at the moment with overall cost of living. And even if we go back to that survey, there was many more questions apart from just kind of parties alignment. There was, we still see cost of living was the second most important issue.
Yeah, cost of living, 42%, one of their two most important issues, housing being number one of 49.
Yeah, and there is a growing, when we look at kind of consumer spending patterns, it's that piece of, well, who is spending? And this is not only in Ireland, it's across many other jurisdictions as well. We know about 10%, or the top 10% of households account for over 50% of wealth within Ireland. And again, we see that across some other economies too. We have seen an increase in supports in more recent years, but of course there was a lot of focus on this budget in ensuring that we increase capital expenditure, which it's back to the infrastructure conversation we already held this morning, while trying to keep a lid on current expenditure. And what I mean by that is that government, when they are spending, you're looking at, well, what can help society in the more long term? And that is delivering on infrastructure deficits, as opposed to increasing more and more our current expenditure that doesn't actually help society in the long term.
Okay, no, I think people would argue that the current expenditure is increasing in ways that don't make a visible difference to so many people, but that this was something. So just to sum up all that, you sound to me like you're very hopeful for the economy over the next few years.
I
pushed it too far again.
Sorry, we are still, let me clarify.
The Economist
that.
Always has the other hand, yeah.
We are still expected to see growth here in Ireland over the next few years. All economic forecasts point to that. But that growth level is expected to moderate versus what we have been used to experiencing over the last few years. And I cannot get away from the fact that we have a lot of external risks that do place a question mark over, can we sustain that?
Yeah, it's more fool me asking about the other hand. You gave us on the one hand, I should have taken it and run with it.
We'll
take
a break.
Mick Clifford, Kate English, John O'Brien and Shane O'Cohen staying with us. Back, our panel still with us. John O'Brien, I had intended to leave more time for Ukraine, but I'm just going to ask you to give us, overnight again, there seem to be positive noises coming out, but I think we're up and down with this, depending on who the last person the Americans met is. Where do you think it's at?
Well, you think economists are depressing, tri political scientists.
Yeah.
Brendan, there is no peace negotiation. This is a surrender negotiation, and it's been that from the very beginning. Putin and Trump are absolutely at one. Ending the war means that Russia gets everything it wants. A few weeks ago, that ridiculous 28-point peace plan, it emerged that it had been entirely written in Moscow. None of this should surprise us when Witkov and Kushner
were
in Moscow.
Yeah, but it has been altered
week.
Since. No hope there, no?
No, we've seen this time and time again. The Russians performatively go along with everything, so do the Ukrainians for different reasons, but there's been no progress made whatsoever. What Trump wants is Ukraine to surrender so that he gets to say, I've solved yet another war. I am the greatest peacemaker of our time. And the other reason that Witkov and Kushner were significant in Moscow is the extractive element. They want to take as much of the natural resources of Ukraine that they can, but they also want to go into business with the Russians. And that was what was really going on, in my view, in both Moscow and in Miami. There is no serious attempt by Russia to engage with Ukraine, to engage with Europe. And that's why what happens tomorrow, which is the meeting between the German Chancellor, the British Prime Minister, Macron and Zelensky, is really important, because this is the time the Europeans have to step up.
Support from Europeans and, you know, standing by Zelensky. We've seen that several times now. It brings things back from the brink briefly, and then on it goes in the direction it's going anyway.
Sure, but this is really important, and we're getting to a point where, for example, on the confiscated Russian assets in Belgium, we have a European Council summit coming up the week after this one coming, and I think that's going to be absolutely pivotal, because the Europeans either decide to do it or they don't.
If Europe stands up here, things could be better, and Europe's at a point of standing up, you think?
This is a pivotal moment for the Europeans. They have to step up, not just for Ukraine, but it's for Europe as well.
Okay. Shaina, just briefly before we finish, there's a small piece in the Sunday Times. Natasha O'Brien, who people will know as a survivor of shocking violence, is leading a campaign to reclaim the tricolour for kind of decent people.
Yeah, and I can totally understand that. I think the flag really isn't the issue. The issue is the dissemination of far-right messaging and mobilization, especially for young men in disadvantaged areas. I think the government needs a strategy to counter that, the narrative of far-right groups and actors like Tommy Robinson. I would support reclaiming the tricolor, but I don't think the tricolor is really the issue. I think it's a larger government
symbols
strategy.
Matter, though, don't they? They do matter, and what they mean. Yeah. Okay, thanks very much. An excellent panel this morning. I think we'd all agree. Mick Clifford, Kate English, John O'Brien, and Shaina Cohen.